Well, I think,
That's what I think,
we should not glorify war, because anybody, a true veteran of war, will tell you that war is hell. It is man-made hell created on Earth.
Yeah, and man-made, and the men are carrying it out.
And there are so many casualties of war. The word collateral damage really means death to men, women, children, grandparents, to families, to communities. Collateral damage means the death of innocence. It's not some generic term that I know that it has become a generic term in the military, but the word collateral damage is robs you of your humanity. You know, the days of war or I should say army on army in the battlefield are long over. And now we're fighting military against civilian, and that's a real problem. A lot of the good-meaning soldiers, sailors, Marines in fighting these wars in the Middle East, they cannot see what the enemy looks like because they're not wearing a uniform. And anyway, things have really gotten beyond the point of ridiculous, and things are collapsing. We're borrowing from China to pay for these wars. The dollar is in great distress. It is obvious that this this artificial system of hierarchical structure, power structure on this planet is collapsing under the weight of its own burden. And it's, frankly, about time. All the people of the world want peace. They want to do business with each other. They want to share. They don't have prejudice in their hearts. It's governments. It's governments and corporations and sovereign wealth funds. It's the big dogs that are stepping all over the little people.
But, okay. Now let me make a point here, Charlotte. When we set out these institutions, are headed up by a lot of men, right? You know? Okay? But now, what gratification, psychological or whatever, do they get out of these? It's aggrandizement at an unprecedented scale of self. You see what I'm saying? So again, you get back to this abstractions of ego building that has no end. But they don't know that it is senseless to continue in that way and those activities, because the very thing that they build builds another endless, you could say, Babylonian temple to hell. See what I mean?
Absolutely.
But
George,
they do not.
I do believe it, I just heard from our radio engineer that Tony Gosling has joined us.
Good.
Welcome
we'll
to
bring
the program.
In then.
Hello, Dan.
Yeah, welcome, Tony. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a bit late at night here, but I'm still awake.
Sorry to get you up so early, man.
I've stayed up quite reasonably late, actually. I'm normally going to bed.
What did you say in one of your deals to me? George's crackers or something?
You were saying you wanted me.
How the English have a better command of the English language than we do, right?
For most of the time, I have to say, sir, you're probably right there. Anyway, it's very exciting, this Bilderberg this year, isn't it? I think you agree.
Yes, it is. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, that we've had quite a lot of what looked like genuine leaks. I mean, you know, the thing is with leaks is always, I mean, ever since I first started doing this, you get leaks before the Bilderberg conference of lists of names and addresses. Some of them are completely bogus. Others are slightly bogus. But the one we've had this year, I trust you've seen it. Hello?
George?
Yeah, yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, George, have you seen the leaked list this year? It came out.
Yeah, I've seen some of those coming out of American Free Press, Jim Tucker.
Good, yeah. Well, there's several people that seem to have got hold of the list this year. And I've had a good look through it this evening, and it does definitely look like it looks like a genuine list. And this is pretty much, as far as I can remember, unprecedented. Normally the lists don't get leaked beforehand, the genuine ones. It's literally the last day of the conference on the Sunday. So I think, you know, this to me rings some very good alarm bells, not alarm bells, but good, because I think that there are a lot of people in the sort of diplomatic and intelligence world that have seen these over the years and have access to them and have not leaked them. Now, last year, the Greek meeting was leaked incredibly by by actually someone at the Dutch embassy, I think in New York, And we're starting to see people in the diplomatic service not now thinking that Bilderberg is too powerful, but actually starting to think, well, actually, the public's got a right to know this. And so I think that the balance is tipping slightly away from them being intimidated by the Bilderbergers. I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, yeah? Tony, I'm Charlotte. It's nice to meet you. I'm thrilled. I think that's a fabulous development.
It is. And looking through this list here, I always sort of pick out a few names. The one name, of course, that's not there, which is always, I don't know if you're a bit obsessed like I am with these lists, clicking through them and saying, oh, who is this guy and who is this person? I mean, we've got the kings and queens, the normal, royalty there. But the one person that's not on the list, who I would suggest is going to be at the meeting, but will be brought in a car with blacked out windows, is Kenneth Clark, the new Lord Chancellor here in Britain.
Oh, boy. Well, Tony, hold that thought. We're going to commercial break, and we'll talk about that, Tony, when we get to the other side. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, along with
Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back, Tony Gosling. I'd like to draw our listening audience's attention to your website, which is Bilderberg.org. Tony, before we left, you had just got done telling us who you thought was not on the leaked list, but who will probably show up. And can you reiterate who that was and why?
Yeah, that's Kenneth Clark. He's a tobacco industry executive who was health minister, etc., as you would expect, of course, under Margaret Thatcher back in the 1980s. And he's just been made, literally 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State for Justice. I mean, this is chilling stuff to have this guy put into these positions, and also Lord Chancellor. Now, historically in Britain, I'm not all that familiar with the American political system, but in Britain, the Lord Chancellor is known as really one of the most powerful people in the country because he has one foot in the camp of the legislature, you know, the lawmakers, and the other camp in the judiciary. And he's really the only senior figure, and he's around the cabinet table too. So he's a very, very powerful chap. He's also very good at spinning himself, you know, and this is one of the things characteristic of these Bilderbergers, as a kind of innocent, you know, sort of jolly chap. And he's got a whole sort of semi-profile as a jazz buff. Just like Ted Heath years ago was a kind of he was an orchestral conductor. He was the Conservative Prime Minister. So I think Kenneth Clark, everybody needs to be really asking, particularly here in the UK, and I doubt if the UK press will do it, but maybe one or two possibly will, say, where are you this weekend? Because obviously the meeting is due to happen next weekend, and it's always very easy for us to say, well, it's happening, we know where it's happening, et cetera, et cetera. But having been to these meetings, you literally never know until the Thursday morning dawns and the security is staked out around the hotel. You're never quite sure whether you've been sold a bum steer.
Well, Tony, how did you get into the Bilderberg, following the Bilderberg and understanding their significance in global power?
Well,
audience a little bit about that.
It started in a really simple way, actually. I was involved in an occupation of a big piece of land, actually, by the River Thames, Wandsworth Bridge, and what we were doing was trying to stop a supermarket. And we'd taken it over. We built an eco-village on the land for about 6 months. There were about something like 30, 40 people living there. And we had a great deal of support from the locals who hated the idea of another giant supermarket there. They already had five or six. They want low-cost housing in that area. And one of the chaps had seen us on the TV and strolled over to me and said, well, it's all very interesting, this land stuff. Yeah, you're right. You know, it's very important. The distribution of land is really crucial. And everybody needs to have a bit of land. There's plenty of land to go around for everyone. But he said also the money problem. And, we need to look at who has control over money and how we've got into this ridiculous habit of having a few private people, you know, issuing and controlling the money. And he said the Bilderbergers. He talked about the Bilderbergers sort of controlling the political system around Europe. And I thought to myself, hang on, this guy's crazy. But I wrote down the name. And when I got back to Oxford, where I was working at the time, I plugged it into the Reuters article database, which was just for the Reuters people, which I'd been given access to for a few weeks. And I had a friend, actually, as well, who was doing this sort of news search service. And the Bilderbergers popped up, and I thought, my goodness, these people really are powerful. And when, of course, you sit down and go through who these people are, they do actually control most of the money in the Western world. We're talking about not just the finance people, but also we've got the Secretary General of NATO there. You know, we've got kings and queens, and we've got some of the big media people, as well as the oil industry, all kinds of big industries. You know, and there's an immense amount of power sitting around that table. And this year, in Spain, I mean, you know, we had the last meeting, of course, in Greece, which has just gone through its rather horrendous financial reorganization, the IMF riots. And so one must wonder, particularly if one's living in Spain, whether the Spanish people are going to be subjected to the same kind of thing in the coming months and year.
So I got into studying
the Bilderbergers while I was at Oxford, as I said there, and it was fantastic because I had access to the Bodleian Library, which is really one of the best libraries in the world, with books going back to the sort of 1500s, 1600s, and in the English Civil War, I was looking through a lot of stuff from the English Civil War, which of course was massively important in world history, as really essentially the birthplace of capitalism, where the merchant classes took over England, and you know, up until then it had been mostly little city states and things like that around places like Venice, and suddenly the merchant classes had a grip. They got rid of Charles I, who actually was really quite a radical reformer. He wanted to stop privatization of land or enclosure, Charles I, and he was beheaded for his trouble. And you saw the rolling out, you know, during that historical period of a whole kind of merchant class, with the City of London taking a grip of the politics of the country and forming laws over the last few hundred years, 350 or so, that enabled the Industrial Revolution here in the UK, in England actually, and then the British Empire, which of course is the biggest the world's ever seen. So, you know, that was how I got into getting to the roots of Bilderberg in the Oxford libraries, digging out the initial material from the 1950s, even actually back to the 40s, and the War and Peace Studies Group, which was part of the, I think it's the CIA or the OSS at the time, and the Council on Foreign Relations, of course. They were the people that actually put the Bilderbergers together, and I was privileged enough, really, to be able to go through their databases and their books, and
yeah, you know,
dig out some of the original material from the formation of it. And the thing that really sparked my interest was this whole thing about Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands that started the whole thing, and he was the first chairman up until 1975 from the 50s, being a Nazi. And not just any old Nazi, he'd been an enthusiastic member of the SS in the run-up to the Second World War, and then, of course, the Bilderbergers will say, oh, of course, you know, he was kind of just doing what everyone else did. But, of course, if you go into it, you'll find that Bernhard, after the Second World War, who was a director of KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, was one of the people instrumental in Project Paperclip, which was springing Nazi war criminals from the jails that were about to go to trial and actually scooting them over to South America. So Bernhard clearly was, you know, a full-blooded Nazi, and to have this guy as the main person running the Bilderbergs right from the very beginning, right up till 1975 and the Lockheed scandal, shocked me so much I thought, well, this is worth putting up on the internet and getting a website going.
Which is Bilderberg.org, which we
That's
would
right.
like to direct our listening audience to get
some articles. Some of the information I have, Tony, is that the CIA funded the first two or three Bilderberg.
I think what he said was that he's on a Skype connection, that the CIA had funded the first few Bilderberg groups. Did you hear that, Tony?
The first meetings, yeah, I think they were. You know, this was clearly was, you know, and you can, in a way, you can kind of understand that U.S. intelligence will very much want the Europeans to be steered across the Atlantic rather than sort of eastward to the Russian bear. And, you know, you can understand that. Particularly because there's you know, nearly 3,000 miles of water between you and us here in Britain, and you know, the obvious tendency is to really sort of make friends with the people who are your continental neighbours, and so you can see. But the trouble was that they chose the Nazis to do it. Basically, you know, people who were still around after the Second World War, And NATO was formed, you know, the earliest meetings were formed by many of the international supporters of the SS. You know, people from Britain who were actually secretly supporting the SS were part of some of the first NATO meetings. So there's a kind of continuity between the Secretary Generals of NATO and the original Nazis, I think.
Yes, and also that could be traced to the United States, to our NASA, and also some of the first, I believe it's the National Security Council. Some very weird things happened after World War II that is definitely not in the history books, and it is very disconcerting and very. It's a big concern that this guy was a Nazi.
I just want to say one thing about the research in the United States on all this stuff. Because there's one guy, Dave Shedrow, I don't know if you've come across him, but he's put an amazing website called Roundtable together, which is all about the Council on Foreign Relations and the origins of the Milner groups, the Roundtable groups, which they came from.
Good information. You said that was Roundtable?
Yes, Roundtable's the website. I've mirrored it on my own site as a sort of subdirectory. But it's brilliant. You know, I think he's done an amazing job on that.
Great. And, of course, people can go to thesecrettruth.com and click off to your site and then launch off onto that. Yeah, there's a lot of information that's getting into the mainstream. Do you think the popular media will pick up on it this year?
Yes, I do, because particularly because all this information has been leaked beforehand, but also because The Guardian covered it last year, and I think it's. And I know Russia Today are planning to send a crew over this year. So, you know, there's definitely going to be a bit of... media there sticking their cameras across the fence or in the noses of people as they come in and out.
Right. David, Tony, can you join us?
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with
Charlotte Littlefield, and welcome back, Tony Gosling of Bilderberg.org. You're calling out to us across the pond from Bristol, England. Is that right, Tony?
That's right. And the other thing is, if anyone wants to hear our radio show we do here in Bristol, it's this week. .org.uk. That's not a very common domain, I imagine, for Americans to dial up. .org.uk because we're non-profit. But we do a review of the news every week. Last week, for example, we did a whole thing about the tyranny of the mobile phone companies. We had an ex Royal Navy microwave warfare engineer telling us about how dangerous these microwaves are, the microwave masts and the phones and all that kind of thing.
Well, tell me, Tony, what are your thoughts about your new conservative government, and what does it all mean?
Well, there's two big Bilderbergers as part of this new government. The first is Kenneth Clark, we were talking about before. He's he's an old timer from Margaret Thatcher's government, and he rose there to be to be Chancellor of the Exchequer under Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, he's one of these people who is really despised by large parts of the Conservative Party because he's so pro-Europe. He's very much pro-EU. He thinks that we really should be run from Brussels, even though he wouldn't actually put it like that. Every kind of change that there is, he wants to sort of push the country further and further towards being run from Belgium. And the other person is George Osborne. He's a bit of a different. He's the generation below Kenneth Clark, really. He's a young boy from Oxford. He was one of the members of this Bullingdon Club alongside David Cameron as the Prime Minister. So there are several. In fact, there's another guy whose name escapes me right now who was also in this Oxford Bullingdon Club. I don't know how many people in the US are familiar with it, but it's a kind of drinking club. It's not like your US fraternities quite so much, but they do have a very strong reputation for lawlessness and sort of getting away with it. You know, what they try and do is they try and sort of smash up the place where they booked for dining, and of course they pay the bill, whatever it is, the next week. And then they have a bit of fun trying to evade the law afterwards. The other thing that is rumoured anyway, and some people have actually said that they've seen this, is that the new members actually get blooded, you know, sort of actually cut with a bit of smashed glass as well. Mm. So this is the kind of culture they're from. They're kind of the thuggish toffs, not the jolly good chap types at all. And that's several members of the new cabinet. But George Osborne, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer here, I mean, I look at him on the TV when he pops up here and I think this guy's a joke. He doesn't really seem to have the gravitas of someone who's dealing with, you know, a modern day multi-billion pound economy. He looks like a kind of joker, a stand-in or something, and he looks rather bemused by it all. We haven't seen hardly anything of him on the TV. And the other thing about all this is that they've had to stitch together a coalition. There's a whole kind of history really here in that really the Conservatives under David Cameron should have managed to win a massive victory over Gordon Brown, because particularly because of the financial crisis that seemed to be sort of related to Brown, and Brown was supposed to be in charge, and it's time to have another, you know, have another, some more people. 30% the Conservatives were ahead in the polls in several months before the general election, and it slowly slid back to virtually zero. So that under David Cameron's leadership, the Conservative Party have completely failed to win the election that was should have been an open door for them. And the reason this has happened is because Cameron, of course, is actually a corporatist. He's an internationalist. He's a Euro lover of the European Union and the City of London. He's not really a traditional Conservative at all. So he's been pushing and pushing and pushing the Conservatives towards this kind of anti-Conservative view and anti-patriotic view. And as a result, he's lost loads of the Conservative votes. And what's happened is the Liberal Democrats picked up votes,
Tony,
and now they hold the balance of power.
Yeah, Tony, do you see a breakup of the European Union? And what are the Euroskepticist people like Daniel Estulin? He's been, you know, after him, and he's going to speak before the Parliament on June 1st, I believe.
I think there's a great...
What are your thoughts on the European Union?
I think there's a great reluctance amongst many civil servants and officials, as well as, obviously, the military and senior diplomats. There is a great reluctance to really move to control by Europe. There are a few people, internationalists and Bilderbergers, people like this, who think it's a great idea. But I think that there's a natural concern about handing power over to some sort of body which, even though most of the people don't think of it as a fascist organization or as a Nazi organization, they see it as a kind of real bureaucratic and foreign organization. So I think there's a reluctance. As regards the economics of it, I'm not an economist, so I can't talk about that. I have no idea whether the sort of crisis in will spread to Spain and this will create. But all I can say is, I think many people here in the UK are very glad that we're not in the euro right now, and that we can still do things like the quantitative easing, as they call it, or print money in order to keep our economy going. Whereas, of course, the Greeks can't. You know, a really crucial part of all this is Bilderberg, actually, because George Papandreou, the Greek Prime Minister, he's been in the situation the last few weeks where he's had to make really big decisions about whether his loyalty is to his country, whether they can revive the drachma, whether they can start to take control of their own currency, or whether that policy is going to be dictated by people like Jean-Paul Trichet from the European Central Bank. And he has made it absolutely obvious to everybody that he's saying that, no, we have no power over this anymore. And that is where Bilderberg had to have somebody in that role to make that decision. If Papandreou had decided, no, I think what we should do is revive our own currency, take control of the Greek economy, then it would have been a whole different scenario, and actually that probably would have wrecked the euro. As it happens, it's still just about holding together. But the Bilderbergers have got to have people in all these countries who are traitors to their own country in order for this plan to succeed. And goodness knows, you know, if the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Italians, you know, if they've got enough political clout in all those countries to make them do what the European Central Bank says against their own national interest.
Well, perhaps Bill Still, the creator of The Secret of Oz, I know he's in Europe, I think, this week and for the coming weeks, Switzerland, I'm not sure where else he was going, Germany, I think, and three different countries. Of course, you're familiar with Bill Still's work.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that it's possible that he could actually reach some of the leadership?
I don't honestly know. I think it's a question of whether the academics usually, I mean, if the academics are into this stuff, But yes, I think, you know, an activist, you know, anybody really who can talk to the right people at the right time and be prepared. I think what's happened in Britain is we have been reasonably well prepared. We can see that the idea of having Brussels running our economy is not necessarily a good one. And, of course, see who pays the piper calls the tune. But anyway, after the break, I'd really like to talk about this shock thing that's happened today, which is the resignation of the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, David Laws.
And maybe the military, subjugation to U.S. military.
Oh, yes, of course.
Let's just talk to things on the other side. Thank you very much for being with us, Tony. We'll be right back.
Be right back.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hey, this is George Butler from Alamo Plaza, along with
Charlotte Littlefield. Welcome back, Tony Gosling. So you were saying you had some information about the Treasury?
That's right. Well, the good ship, David Cameron, and his wonderful new British government, Conservative government, if you believe that, they've taken quite a nasty hit in the side of the ship, and it's listing to one side. I think they're trying to plug the gap right as we speak, because today the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, who's a Liberal MP, David Laws, has had to resign. Well, I mean, you know, he didn't have to resign, but he did have to. He is really an very important figure in this new government, because the way that the Conservative Party are running it is that they've got the people from the Liberal coalition to do all the dirty work. So whenever there's some nasty announcement about, oh, we're going to be cutting all people's benefits or welfare payments, or as you call them over there, obviously it's always a Liberal Democrat that trots out onto the screen to make the announcement, you know, for the Conservatives. So that's the kind of coalition it is. And David Laws has been on the TV and radio earlier this week talking about all these horrendous swinging cuts that they want to introduce immediately, as soon as this new Conservative government have got into power. And so everything is really riding on him. Now, he has just literally this morning resigned here in Britain, because it's been revealed in the Daily Telegraph, which is generally Tory paper, run by the Barclay twins, who live as tax exiles in the Channel Islands. It's been revealed by them that he has actually paid £40,000 worth of taxpayers' money to his boyfriend, pretending that he didn't know his boyfriend, and that it was just his landlord. And it's now come out that that actually it was his long-term partner that he was paying this public money to, and so he's done the right thing and he's resigned, which is a really is a serious hole in the side of the new coalition between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives. So this will be bad news for Mr. Cameron, and I'm very glad to hear it, because I don't like what they're planning. I mean, the idea of cutting right now, just as the recession is starting to go away and we're starting to get a little bit of movement in the economy. Like I say, I'm not an economist, but I can see that now is absolutely the worst time to be sacking loads of public sector workers, and so hopefully this will mean possibly that they're lacking credibility. But more importantly, this is a sign that maybe that this coalition agreement between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives isn't going to last as long as they hoped it would be. They were saying it was going to last for 5 years, and I don't really think that that's possible. So,
excuse me, I have a tumor in my throat.
Okay, well, anyway, the other thing we were going to talk about was another, you know, it's always interesting to see when the government gets in, you get a few surprises. And one of the things that I noticed, which was, and it's weird the way the BBC operates, you know, you got to love them, but, I mean, they're really, it can be so annoying, was just a few bulletins that on the Radio 4, which is like used to be the home service, it's like our main radio station here, talk radio and news during the day, and announced that British troops in Helmand province in Afghanistan were coming under US command. Now, as far as the military contacts I've got, this is one thing that they have made absolutely adamant that they don't want, and this is something that the politicians are starting to force upon the military. Now, that's not very clever from the politicians' point of view, really is a silly thing to do, because you start pushing the military around, getting them to do things. We've had lots of blue-on-blue incidents over the years with the U.S., not least of which in the first Gulf War, where, you know, there were real serious confrontations actually between senior officers in the U.S. forces and the senior officers in the British, you know, commanders of the forces in the first Gulf War, where the British were announcing that these blue-on-blue incidents are straight to the families of the victims, and there was a big dispute at the time between Peter de la Billière, who was commanding the British forces, and I think it was Schwarzkopf. Schwarzkopf was telling the British that they shouldn't do this, you know, because this, it looks bad in the press. And this is, of course, sort of nose-to-nose standoff at that point, where, to his credit, Billière was saying, look, at the end of the day, we are not lying to the families of the men that have just died. You know, this is one of the things we do in the military, is we make sure that the next of kin know what's happened as soon as possible. And we don't lie to them. And, you know, it was sort of like, you know, who the hell do you think you are to tell me how to deal with the bereaved loved ones of soldiers that you have just killed? And this is the kind of thing I think that many of the military in this country will be worried now, and when there are, and of course there will be, other friendly fire, they call it, I call it unfriendly fire, incidents where American troops, usually it seems to be, are killing British troops, that then tempers might flare again.
Tragic, no question about it.
And you know what happened in Afghanistan and Iraq was there were very, very solid lines drawn in the operational areas. This is our side of the line. That's your side of the line. A bit like the oil cartels might divide up, or drug gangs might divide the city up. You know, you've got one side of the line is your side. This side of the street is mine. That side of the street is yours. Don't come over this side of the street, or you might get shot. And that is actually, I think, the most effective way to run things, because there's then no confusion. And what happens, of course, in the fog of war is there's always a bit of confusion and someone is going to get killed. And it's especially resented if it's a different nationality that's been responsible for that decision that they're under their command. So, I think they've made a big mistake in doing this, and I don't think the military will react well to it. Our military will anyway. That was a total surprise to me, because I know 40 Commando, which is a Royal Marines unit, which is based down here in the West Country near Taunton. This is a few years ago. Tony Blair had just come back from seeing George Bush over there, and he'd agreed for a small contingent to go under US command while he was over in Washington. And 40 Commando simply just did not go. You know, they stayed in their barracks. It's like, no, we're not going, Tony. You can't go over and tell us that we're now under U.S. command. We don't do things like that. So you can see that the military is slowly being cajoled into trying to do this. And I think you're right to point it out as quite, you know, an important thing for me to discuss and talk about, because it's what it's all about at the end of the day. You know, the politicians are one thing, but the military, if the politicians and the military, the relationship between them starts breaking down, then you've got real serious problems. And, you know, we don't really want that here in Britain, and I think Mr. Cameron is really pushing it a bit too far. He's used to this, of course, being a Bullingdon boy and a bully boy. He likes to push his weight, throw his weight around. His face has changed from this sort of smiley face before the election to this real hard man, like, I'm going to be tough with you, I'm going to kick, you know. And I don't think that he's going to get a very good reception amongst the military.
Interesting. Let's take it back to the Bilderberg. So you said earlier that you don't like to delve too much into the agenda because generally they change it anyway. Because what's going to happen. Do you have any predictions of what might come out of this one?
I think it's fun. I don't really honestly want to predict this. I mean, you know, we've got all sorts of stuff going on in the world that wasn't going on this time last year. All this stuff in North Korea, which is clearly being orchestrated, an orchestrated conflict. I think many people around the world have started to see that, you know. But as regards what's really on the agenda,
well, Tony, we got to go. I thank you for being with us.